Oh, kia ora tato, how are you? Good to see you all. Good lunch?
Yeah, fantastic, eh? Okay.
Oh, well, in the next 35 minutes, I'm going to take you on a journey through 200 years of history. And then I'd like to reserve time within that by some miracle to take you just on a predictive journey into what might come up, I think, in the next 20, 40 years in the area of biculturalism. Now, my own involvement in this journey would be that we returned to New Zealand the end of 2010, I think it was. And in looking at how we might get Christianity back in the public square, you're really looking for platforms for media projects. And it was suggested to me that the 2014 bicentenary of the gospel's first preaching in New Zealand would be a good opportunity. So I began to investigate that. And really, we've got academics in our universities who've done a splendid job on this with things that haven't been talked about for many decades. Lynn Carpenter, Bruce Patrick and others became the connectors between the academics. Then they ran a hui, New Zealand Christian Congress 2012, 2013, something like that. And a number of us were there and this really captured our hearts. And so as creatives, we've taken it through different media. I've taken it into the public square through the Hope Project. I then became the producer of a series of illustrated history stories. We've done 10 biographies so far. And then we did a series on Te Tiriti o Waitangi, which I'm talking about today. All of these stories are pretty unique, and I'd like to sell them all to you. They are $64.90 for a series of five. There's 15 in total. The treaty series is here today, and I'm going to sell it just for $50 to encourage you to get it. It is illustrated history, they're illustrated novels, but they've got loads of details. They're also not just a writing on the basis of historical books. They also include travel to meet with the descendants of those involved, whether they're Māori and the iwi, or whether they're Pākehā as well. And that leads to lots of editing of details, not only in the writing of them, but also in terms of the artwork and what do the descendants of different people believe their ancestors to have been like in personality and in all of this. So they're actually phenomenally thorough and a completely unique resource. As I grew up, having come to faith, I had this intuition sense that Christianity had failed Māori. And I had this sense of shame that somehow, while Christianity was awesome, I'd come to faith in new God, that we were somehow the baddies. And I could never work out what it was. And in coming to understand this history, I've realized that there's been phenomenal misrepresentation of history. And so this is something very, very important for us to know about. Public education on Te Tiriti o Waitangi is very, very narrow and very limited. Even the government's website is guilty of this. Basically, there are two parties in our history. Here's the history. Māori, they're the victims. Pākehā, they're the perpetrators. But history is never so simple. And to break it down very briefly, because everything has to be brief in what I'm trying to cover in 30 minutes, at the centre of the stage, you've got Māori, tangata whenua, they're the first on the stage. The next you have on the stage, over on the side, are the whalers, sealers and traders. They're here for a profit. They don't care about the Māori, except they wouldn't mind having a few girls that they could, you know, have for their pleasures. They want the booze, they want the trade, they want money. They're unscrupulous, they're dishonest, they're violent, surprisingly so. Next on the stage is the missionary. And where's the missionary on the stage? Right next to the Māori. No question. They came with a motive and a heart to help the Māori, including spirituality, but they had a very holistic view of mission. And that's a story that hasn't been told. It was an altruistic, all true motive. Next on the stage are the settlers. And if you imagine them being on the other side of the stage here, they have come with no regard for Māori. They're just a bunch of brown people. We don't need to worry about them. We're the colonizers taking over this nation, helping to civilize them because really they need nothing. They kind of need rescuing from their primitive lifestyles and their primitive culture. So, but we've come here. We're not bad people. We go to church on Sunday. But we've come here for a better life because we've been living in the slums in England. We've got our children dying sometimes of malnutrition, things in England where it wasn't Christian England back then. We've got an opportunity at something better. So we want land. The last on the stage, right? So tangata whenua, Māori, whalers, sealers, traders, missionaries, settlers, is the crown. This is the British government, and the British government's walking around, and the question is, who is the British government going to become friends with? Is it going to be with the Māori because of the missionaries, or is it going to be with the settlers? Because the fact is, no matter how much you esteem Māori, they were a primitive tribal people In contrast to the Europeans who were colonizers with numbers, with technologies, and with weapons. When it comes to the battle between the two, there really is no battle. The conclusion is known before the battle even begins. And the only reason we have Te Tiriti o Waitangi, the Treaty of Waitangi, is because of the amazing work of the missionaries. And they managed to get the crown on board, standing over here and having a little hug together for about 1 to 2 years within which the Treaty of Waitangi came about. The question is how and why. The history for that goes back into the 1700s, and if you come through, jumping quickly through it, the Clapham sect, a group at a place called Clapham, they were evangelical, Bible-believing Christians. They felt a responsibility to change the world. They took on slavery and had success against the slave trade in 1807. This gave them confidence to believe that they could change the world. More than 230 charitable societies resulted from that in the following 30, 40 years, each advocating for the rights of a different group of people in some way around the globe. One of the first societies they created prior to their initial success was the Church Missionary Society in 1799, which had significant influence here in New Zealand. Now, the Gospels' arrival, many of them, the point there is, were actually anti-colonialistic. In other words, as they had success against the slave trade, and then they took on slavery itself, which took until the late 1830s, they looked at colonization and they thought, isn't colonization really just another form of slavery? We make slaves of people on their own land by robbing them of that land and their culture and everything else and forcing them to be like us. And so when the missionaries are arriving here in New Zealand, they are significantly anti-colonialistic. They have a goal. They actually don't want New Zealand to become colonized. Their interest is the well-being of the Māori. Now, the arrival and spread of the gospel here is a significant part of the story as well. I grew up by intuition after coming to faith with this idea that Christianity was somehow an imposition of colonization. And this would still be the common view in New Zealand. The truth is, it was not an imposition of colonization. It was invited by a Ngāpuhi chief, Ruatara, whose pā was called Rangihaua in Oihi Bay, 30 minutes out of Kerikeri. He had developed a relationship over a number of years with the Reverend Samuel Marsden, who in fact had found him basically enslaved on a ship coming out of England. Long story, no time for it. And he was sick with tuberculosis, coughing up blood, you know, it eventually kills you. And he said, "What are you doing in the bowels of the ship where the slaves would have been?" Drags him into his own cabin and begins to nurse him back to health. Ruatara stays with Marsden in his home and farm in Parramatta, Sydney, for around about 7 or 8 months after that. And Marsden's intent in getting the New Zealand mission started is, number one, he doesn't come till he's invited, because the Māori are the tangata whenua. They're the sovereigns of this land, so I have no right to come unless they invite. So they respected the Māori people as equals. God made all people equal. But his missionary policy was to civilize before Christianize. Now, words change meaning. To put this in modern day language, his mission policy was, we're going to run community ministries and spend all of our money helping people, and we're going to not tell them about Jesus very much for years and years and years, until by all our good works and love, they realize that our Christianity must be true. Then we'll preach and they'll come to Christ. Okay, so his form of Christianity was the one that I disagree with, because I think the good works and the gospel should always go hand in hand. And this became an issue of contention in the early mission, and 12, 13 years later, the missionary Henry Williams came, and he said, "What are we doing here? We should be preaching Jesus. He says, love your enemies. Isn't there's no message more powerful than that that's needed in this environment." And so the whole spirit of the mission began to change. And so the gospel was invited. Long story short, first Sunday in New Zealand was Christmas Day 1814. That's the first true Kiwi Christmas. And we're going to create a children's story next year by that title to try to sell right around the country for younger children. The first preaching of the gospel, possibly in Te Reo by Marsden, but if not, Ruatara translated, also was immediately followed by the first invited European settlement. So settlement here, that settlement wasn't an imposition or a colonization, that was invited out of mutual relationship and trust that had formed over a period of a number of years. Three families, the Kings, the Kendalls, and the Halls, stayed. The fella king was particularly good friends with Ruatara. Now, all of this carries on, and this history carries on with all of its bumps. Māori were a feudal tribal people. There was cannibalism, Utu revenge wars. You got the musket wars that come into the picture. There is human sacrifice. There is infanticide. I was in a meeting just 2 days ago looking at some resources we're trying to create next year. One of the side stories that we won't tell of, you know, a Māori's walking through, he meets a woman. So what he does, she's got a child, kills the child in front of her, cooks the child, eats the child, rapes the woman and says, "Now you're my wife." And the power of that story, this is around the same time as the treaty, the power of that story is that they later both became Christians and ended up being very happily married. You know, but this is the environment that we're in, just to get a picture so we haven't got any blinkers over top of us. 1836, it all changes. A bill is passed in British Parliament that opens New Zealand to limited colonisation. Got a phone call, that'll have to wait. Now, there's a fella there, Wakefield. It could be one of you guys. I don't know. Yeah, it just stopped. A fella in England called Wakefield says, "Great, here's an opportunity." It was an opportunity to make money, but to be true to him, it was an opportunity to also do good. Here are people in slums, like I said before, even dying of starvation from malnutrition. If you can imagine the scenario, if we could repatriate them on ships over to New Zealand, they could have a chance at a new life. So he actually had a desire to do good whilst making himself a truckload of money. What he couldn't see, because of the colonial mindset of the majority of all people in all of Europe at that time, was that he was going to be walking right over top of some people who happened to already live in New Zealand. It just happened to already be occupied. His first ships to come out here of settlers were coming out by 1839. The history moved very quickly, and the question is, how do we even end up with a treaty if New Zealand there was permission to colonise it? And the answer is, those evangelical Christians had worked their way into government and into different positions. The world was changed, not by people preaching from pulpits, actually that's the trigger point I would say it was, but it was changed by the people who got the message and took it into their careers and their professional lives. There was Lord Glenelg and James Stevens were in Parliament at the time that Wakefield began to have plans for New Zealand. They were both evangelical Christians. James Stevens was the nephew of the great William Wilberforce, responsible for stopping the slave trade. And they were horrified at these plans, and they thought, what can we do? And they began to talk. So they decided to find another of their Christian friends, a guy named William Hobson, and say, "We're going to send you over to New Zealand, we'll fund it, and go and find out what the situation is there, because we know we need to do something." So he takes a recce trip over to New Zealand, checks out the scenario, interviews everybody, and comes back with his PowerPoint presentation to basically show them the situation. And they realize they've got to act really fast. In the meantime, Wakefield gets wind of what they're trying to do, so he quickly commissions his brother-in-law to come over here and start purchasing land, because he's already selling New Zealand land, and he hasn't purchased his first piece of it yet. There's a change in people in government. James Stevens is still around, but the new key figure becomes Lord Normanby. Guess what? Another evangelical Christian. And so James Stevens has penned thoughts for this ridiculous idealistic treaty that could be made with Māori that protects them, that gives them the rights of British citizenship, which means we see you as equals, not as subservient. That's very significant in that day and age. But also full protection of your lands and your culture. If you want it, you can sell your land or you can keep your land. Land was already being ripped off Māori, being purchased for a tin of nails or whatever else it was. And so these protections were desperately needed. And Māori were understanding it was needed. They also didn't like the behaviour of the whalers, sealers and traders, who in particular would base themselves around Kororareka, which is Russell up in Northland. And those Māori who had travelled even more so understood what was coming. Because the settlers were on their way. There were 2,000 settlers already by 1840. They were clearly going to take over because they'd travelled to England, they'd travelled to Australia. They knew the colonising power of Europe. They knew that the Māori people didn't actually have a hope if the white fella decided he was going to come. And so this idealistic list of 8 pages of thoughts goes through Lord Normanby and gets passed to Hobson, and he gets given governmental position to become the governor of New Zealand and to establish a treaty with the Māori people, who are now recognised as the Māori people singular, not peoples, because of the Declaration of Independence, which is Te Whakapūtanga or Te Rangatiratanga or Niu Tirinei, the Declaration of the sovereign chiefs of New Zealand, where about 34 chiefs declared we are one. And so that gave a basis to actually say there is a people here to have a treaty with, even though the reality on the grass was still the Māori peoples, plural, not the Māori people. The commission to Hobson, this is important to catch, was that your job is to stop this disaster, that's referring to colonisation. Your mission is to stop this disaster, but if not possible, to mitigate it. And to mitigate means to soften. And those are the specific words that he is given with this commission. That's highly significant because it shows the motives sitting behind the governmental missionary people who are collaborating together through their Christian faith to try to get a treaty in place to protect the Māori. It is to stop the disaster of colonization, that's their worldview, but if not possible, to mitigate it, to soften the blow of it. Everyone's surprised with the words sitting inside the notes passed over. In New Zealand concurrently, the gospel is taking off. And to give you a number of stories, and we've done biographies on nearly every person I'll mention, which you could purchase online at bigbook.nz, and I'd encourage you to do that. The gospel has taken hold of Ngāpuhi, that sentence is worded wrong. They chose to embrace faith, having watched the lifestyles of missionaries for 30 years almost, and having heard the message and realizing there is something very fundamentally different about the missionaries as compared to the whalers, sealers, traders, and the settlers. There is a spiritual reality and truth and difference here which is like gold. And so the gospel becomes embraced by Ngāpuhi. The cannibalism, the human sacrifice, the infanticide, the everything else begins to stop, but also slavery. Now, there's kind of slavery that's really bad and slavery that's kind of bad. That's a conversation for another time. Their slavery wasn't really bad, but it was bad, or not so bad, depending who you want to debate with. But the fact is they released their slaves. And these slaves had been exposed to Christianity and to the gospel, and many of them had become faith as a result of the process. Some of the more notable ones went and served on mission stations for a period of time, understanding the word of God, learning to read, because the missionaries with others had created the written Māori language. They translated the Anglican prayer book, they translated the Gospel of Luke, then the New Testament, about 30, 40 years later, the Old Testament. And so you get guys like Mina Raparangi Hotuaki, who goes through Taranaki back to his own people. They're living down in Waikanae, goes to Waikanae, brings the gospel, first church down in Wellington. You get Piripi Taumata Rakuda, who gets released. He goes round back to where he is on the East Cape, round Gisborne area, preaches the gospel, revered there to this day. They embrace Christianity. And then you get a guy whose name is, was Mataho, his name more correctly is Ripaho. And he becomes a key to a story, which is the famous one known as the Tarore story, which in reality isn't her story at all. It's Ngākuku's. Ngākuku is a chief Ngāti Hoa in Waikato, and he has embraced Christianity. And he's got a Gospel of Luke, and his name's in it. And they're moving some people away for safety across the Kaimais, but they get found out because of the smoke of one of their fires. And so some Māori from Rosarua come through, and in the process, they run for their lives in the dark, and his daughter Tarore gets killed, and his Gospel of Luke gets stolen. He decides afterwards, I'm going to forgive and I'm not going to get revenge. Because how long's this bloodshed going to keep on going for? Pretty radical. And everyone thinks he's crazy. But at the same time, the gospel's there sitting in Rotorua and it begins to be read because other escaped slaves have come through. There's no evidence that Ripaho was there. He may have been, he may not have been. And so they begin to learn to read and they embrace Christ. And Chief Uita, who's responsible for the murder of Tarore, comes under conviction and says, I'm going to apologize. So he sends messengers first of all to state his intentions. Then he decides to travel and to actually go and apologize face-to-face to Ngākuku for murdering his daughter. All of his tribespeople say, you should not go. He is absolutely guaranteed to kill you, because that's how it's been for hundreds of years. But he goes anyway. He gets down on his knees to say sorry, and they end up, they get on their knees together and they pray together. And this story becomes quite powerful and catalytic. It wouldn't be the only story like it, but it's the most well-known one. Ripaho is now down in Waikanae sharing the gospel with people there, and they want more of the scriptures. And so he's sent back up to Rotorua to get some. He happens to come back with Ngākuku's Gospel of Luke. Now, at Waikanae, what you've got there is the warring chief Te Rauparaha and his son, whose name is Wiramu Tamihana normally, but his correct name is Katu, and his nephew Martine, whose correct name is Te Fifi. In most histories, you'll have those names. The descendants say, we want the use of these names. So that's Katu and Te Fifi. in our stories. Kato and Te Fifi come under conviction and begin to believe the gospel of Jesus. Te Rauparaha doesn't like it because they want to forgive enemies and even go and apologise to them. Kato and Te Fifi go to the South Island, and they're some of a number who then take the gospel to the South Island. Of note, Christianity arrived at the invitation of Māori, was preached by missionaries, accepted by Northland Māori. It was then spread by Māori right throughout the nation. That's a powerful piece of story and history there to understand. After all of this, they think we need ourselves a white missionary to teach us stuff that we don't know, because they've known about this book for years. So they get on a ship and they go up to Paihia, where the mission base is, to meet the great Henry Williams, who's been a naval ship's captain in the Napoleonic Wars and has seen enough bloodshed for two or three lifetimes. He's now become a missionary and he's fearless. And so there is a musket war going on in this room between this side and this side, and this is Henry Williams. Walks upright, never takes cover, straight up and says, "Put your weapons down," in Te Reo, and he's telling them off. God tells us we're supposed to love our enemies. And he's like a god. He walks around, he's indestructible, he doesn't get hit by bullets. He is an absolute legend, and he has so much mana amongst the Māori because of how he is. He's known as Karu Fa, which means four eyes, because he wore little spectacles like this. So they come to him and say, "We need a missionary." And he says, "We ain't got anybody." But 2 weeks off a ship, listening in the corners, this young 20-year-old, scrawny kind of fella, Octavius Hadfield, who's become a missionary because he's so sickly he's expected to die quite soon. He wants to do good before he dies. His family think the idea is dumb, but he's like, "I'm going to die, it's my life," and he jumps on a ship to become a missionary. And so he says, "I'll go." And so Henry Williams, long story short, goes, "All right then," and they get on a ship and they go down. Now, by the way, Octavius Hadfield, we've got his biography, Henry Williams, we've created his biography in the stories. Octavius Hadfield is hailed as the greatest New Zealander to have ever lived. I tell you, there is a phenomenal story sitting in that man's life because he survives for 60 more years, despite it all. So he's taken down to Wellington. The ship is blown off course and they find themselves in Nelson. And holy crap, the Wakefield's brother's here and he's just purchased all of this land. And there's all this tension and conflict going on. They get back on course and they come into Wellington Harbour. And I'll just say it again, holy crap. The whole harbour's been purchased for hardly anything. And the Māori are all confused because they're expected to get off their land. And they don't really know what's going on. This, all their letters they've been writing about the need to act and protect Māori, this isn't just something that's kind of urgent. This is now far more than pressing because hundreds of thousands, if not hundreds of millions of hectares of land was already taken, 1839. And so Octavius gets settled and Henry Williams has got to get back quick, so he walks. He walks from Wellington to Tauranga, catches a ship back to Paihia and... Yeah, and arrives in Paihia. I can tell you a story of a pregnant woman taking a walk like that at 8 months pregnant. They were tough for the gospel. And he arrives back there, if I have it correct, only about 8 to 12 days before Hobson arrives back for the second time, with a whole lot of documents from Lord Normanby to put a treaty in place. The whole scene is set. You've got Māori who have travelled, you've got missionaries who are convinced, and you've got news right now of land purchased in Nelson and Wellington without consent unjustly, while Baron de Thierry from France wants to declare a republic up at Hokianga and to actually take over that whole Northland part of the island. The Māori and the missionaries understand what is going on. They are not dumb. And so you come into the treaty being put together. It's a messy thing, and this series can really explain some of that mess to you. The dynamics are really quite interesting. Long story short is that Hobson falls ill. He actually dies about 2-3 years later. And he is unable to prepare the treaty itself off these 8 pages of notes. And last minute, James Busby, who was the regent, he was called the man of war without guns. He was supposed to keep order, but he had no police and no power. So what kind of position is that? He ends up writing it, and on the night before, at 4 p.m, it's given to Henry Williams and his son to translate into Te Reo Māori, and then it all needs printing in that same window of time, ready for the hui that they've organised with Colenso and his printing press, having created the flyer and sent that out sort of a week or two in advance so that Māori chiefs could gather. you end up with a pretty colourful dialogue that goes on within that. But in the room, you've got a number of Māori who have firmly embraced the faith. Patuone, an amazing story, because he ate a piece of pork from Captain Cook's ship when Captain Cook first arrived. His dad, a chief, went out and came back. He was 5 years old and gave him it. Here he is years later at the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi. He'd been baptised 10 days prior by Henry Williams. So Henry Williams must have been back 12 days or something before Hobson arrived. You've got Wakanene, who's a relative of his. You've got Hongi Hika there, who has decidedly embraced Christian things, irrespective of what others might say today. There's others in the room whose names I can't remember, Kutupupu or something. It's all yous, whatever it is. Four of them. He's there as well. At the end of the day, you've got this very sincere statement from Hongi Hika. Now, modern history doesn't tell you any of this Christian stuff. It's all left out. Māori are the victims, Pākehā are the perpetrators. The real story is more dynamic, more interesting, and there's Pākehā heroes. I think that's quite strategic for our biculturalism in the future as well. Hongi Hika is often, he's there and he says, at the end of it he says, who are we, mere natives, to make this decision? It's for you, our fathers, the missionaries, to decide for us. And you, Governor Hobson, like that. Now, the way that it's put in the modern tellings of history is that it's, who are we, mere natives? It's for you, the missionaries. And he's looking off to his mates and they're all having a laugh because he's mocking the missionaries, he's mocking Hobson. But that's not the case. The fella walks around with a Bible everywhere he goes. You know, he's embraced faith. He understands those missionaries had mana. They knew their stuff. They knew the geopolitical environment. They knew about the land already being purchased in the areas that I have mentioned. They knew the urgency. Hongi Hika was no fool. He was a part of a confederation of chiefs that existed from 1812 that met, that had a scribe whose name was Waikato. And he had been to meet Governor King because they wanted trade opportunities and they united for trade instead of fighting each other for wealth. He'd been over to Sydney. He'd been to meet the King of England. He'd travelled. He knew the power of Europe. He knew that when the missionaries were saying, you need this, the first ships with settlers were already arriving. 2,000 settlers. And so Te Tiriti o Waitangi, the Treaty of Waitangi, comes into effect, granting Māori equal rights as citizens under the British government and also the protection of their lands, some protections intended for the fair sale of their land in the face of injustices. All of that was corrupted later, if you know the stories. It is an absolutely remarkable document. And if you are non-Māori like myself, you are the tangata tiriti, where Māori are the tangata whenua. You are the people of the treaty. It's your only right to be here. If you don't like the treaty, you're an invader and a coloniser. Leave. You have to like the treaty. Yeah, honestly, yeah. You have to like the treaty because it's the only legal reason why you have genuine right to be here. This is your land too because of Te Tiriti or Waitangi. Where this goes next is where it begins to get devastating. Because there were 2,000 settlers, as I said, in 1840, 12,700 within 5 years. Jump forward to the turn of the century and there were 800,000 settlers. In Māori, maybe there were 80,000 in 1840. 60 years later, there were 46,000 Māori compared to 800,000 settlers. So in 60 years, whatever the things are, it went like that in terms of population demographics, but also in power. The missionaries were trying to serve the Māori and they're getting told they're not allowed to speak in Māori and not allowed to teach in Māori and not allowed to run churches for Māori. The missionaries got crucified, the long and short. It was unjust and it was terrible, but it had nothing on what happened to the Māori. The Māori, their schools were closed down after the missionary schools were closed down. By 1890, if a Māori kid were to use a te reo word in a school, they would be punished for it. I think the treaty was really betrayed within a year. It was within a year of the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi, if you remember the different people on stage. The Crown needed to appoint a land purchasing agent on behalf of the Crown. Do you know who they appointed? They appointed the New Zealand Company. Which means that the allegiance of the Crown shifted from the missionaries and Māori across to here within 1 year of the treaty. You had bloodshed within 5 years, and if you jump forward 20 years, you've got the land wars. You've got Whitumu Kingi from Waikato, living down at that time as many of the Taranaki Māori were in Waikanae area, and you've got Octavius Headfield the Great. And he's saying to him, look, there's no way that your lands will be taken without your permission, because one of his men had just sold all of his lands at Waitara. He can't sell your lands, you're the chief. But Governor Brown wanted land and said, I bought that land. And so he goes down to occupy his land to make sure it doesn't get taken. And unbelievably, he gets attacked and he gets his land taken off him because one of his men without his permission had sold it. At this point, Octavius Headfield has a life crisis. He's been trying to be a man of the cloth, but now he needs to engage in political activism. He didn't want to. And so his faith, his love for God, and his sense of justice forced him out of his convictions to only be a man of the cloth, to begin to serve both things at the same time. He became absolutely prolific in his activism to England to try to switch things and to protect the Māori. Imagine Winamu Kingi then years later, he's got nothing. He's been the chief with all of this land and all of these people. Now he can't protect them. So fend for yourself, fend for yourself, fend for yourself. I'm not callous. I can't help you. I've got no land. I've got no job for you. I've got no food for you. I'm just a man like any other man. And so he wanders around. And so he goes and lives in the bush for a while, just by himself, probably with his wife or wives. I don't know how many he had and whatever else. Then he comes back and catch this. And he made no trouble for the people living on his land. Came back and introduced himself to them. To people living on his lands that have been ripped off. Then he goes down and spends some time at Parihaka, which was really a Christian movement that doesn't get credited today. And they were at Parihaka, what it was about was the Māori trying to work out, what do you do if you kind of believe in a God and in good, but you're facing the encroaching Pākehā taking your land unjustly? How do you reconcile this? How do you heal from this without being completely screwed up in your head? And Winamu Kingi finished his life living a native life. In other words, living bush somewhere up the Whanganui River. Imagine how soul-destroyed the man must have been. Winamu Tamihana Tarapipipi Waharoa is another powerful story. His English name's the first bit, which is the first English name is Katu, Te Rauparaha's son. His Māori name, Tarapipipi Waharoa, the son of the great warring chief Waharoa over the hill from us here at Maramara. He's there on his land. He's a devout Christian. It's like Parihaka. He's a pacifist. The Bible is read and there are devotions at 7 a.m. in the village every morning. They've got crops. They've got, you know, everything going on. They've got trade going on. This is an honourable, God-fearing community. This is New Zealand's one of the greatest mission success stories in all of mission history, in case you're not aware. And here he is. And then the invasion road is made from Auckland through Waikato. And understand, at first I felt sceptical and thought, nah, that's like anti-colonialist Maori talk about invasion roads. No, it actually was an invasion road. This is what I've concluded having looked at it. Now, they wanted the land. You have to have a road through to get access to the land that you intend to take or get by whatever means. So Waikato Māori begin to try and stop this advance of the of this colonial colonising road. And there's a lot of bloodshed. Tarapipipi refuses to join it because he's a pacifist and this isn't the way of God. Eventually, they hide some of their women and children in a village in some huts. And when the colonial troops come in the process of that, a number of the huts are set on fire. And a number of the women and children get burnt alive within there. What is Tarapipipi to do? These are his people. He's the chief. He's responsible for them. And he sees no choice but to pick up a weapon and pick up a musket, taiha, whatever, and to begin to join the fight because it's now right on his doorstep, taking over his land. But he realizes quickly that fighting was a mistake because you can't fight the power of Britain because it's too powerful. And so he goes and he takes, mere, and he puts it at the ground like this before Governor... I can't remember if it was Grey or Brown. And it's taken as being his surrender, but it wasn't. It was his token of peace to say, no, let's come back to a treaty of peace. And because Tarapipipi has dared to fight against the crown, the consequence was the confiscation of his lands. And so he lost everything that he owned. To understand the depth of faith that these Māori leaders had in that day, when Tarapipipi died years later, we've got his story in one of our biographies, his last words were to his men were, honour the ways of God and of man. Honour the ways of God and of man. In other words, don't go forward with bitterness. We have lost absolutely everything. We will honour God. We will honour the ways of man. Just to give you another guy's last words, Henry Williams, his last words were something to the effect of, oh, how sad. After a lifetime of service in one of the greatest and most successful missions in Christian history, but then so severely screwed up by colonization. The journey toward reconciliation has been painful, and Te Reo schools, I've mentioned, were closed, but in the 1830s, Aparangasa began to get manual Māori arts back into schools. You had Lord Bledisloe, who was a Governor General, who purchased the land at Waitangi. It was just a piece of derelict bush no one was using. It was a wasteland, and said, "Nah, this had significance in our history," and he gifted it to the Crown. You come forward to Dame Fina Cooper, whose granddaughter actually launched the series at Waitangi on Waitangi weekend 2 years ago. And she leads the march from way up north through to Wellington in 1975 and really rallies the support and a petition to petition the government that there's actually a gross injustice within our history that we're culpable for and need to address. And so you have the beginnings of some laws in Parliament which take another 10 years to result in the validating of justice claims on land stuff related to Māori against the Crown dating back to 1840. So that's endorsed in 1985, which brings about the Treaty of Waitangi Tribunal. I want to help you understand what a settlement process is. I'm going to end up struggling for time here, but I am doing an hour and a half presentation in 30 minutes. You know, I'm trying, but the points here, I think that they're important. We need to understand this. I want you to imagine that your family are a farming family. Just for argument's sake, you're a male and you get put in charge of all of these farms. You own 10 farms, valued today at least $4 million each. We're talking about $40 million of asset. You've got most of your family members, your whānau, they're working on this farm, that farm and the other. You look after everybody. You're the chief. You're 35 years of age, married, got a couple of kids. And in the process of some gross injustices, suddenly one day, you've lost everything that you own. They're all taken away. Your families are all kicked off those various farms. You don't own any of them. You own literally nothing. You're kicked up on your backside. And you have to go and get a labouring job somewhere to try to pay for food for your family. So what happens is that you become depressed. Surprise, surprise. And in your depression, you begin to drink a little bit too much, and maybe you're not the father that you could have been to your children. You know, you're emotionally messed up trying to work out what to do. You're supposed to defend this. You're dishonouring your father and your father's father and your great-grandfather. They'd farmed these farms for generations, and you just lost possession of them. What a loser you are. And so, loser that you are in your depression, you don't father your kids as you should. And, you know, they kind of go off the rails. And this one does drugs and this one's doing crime. And they begin to sleep around and have kids there and sleep with someone else and have kids there and someone else there. And then there's a second generation and a third generation and there's a fourth generation. And you're 65, 70 years of age now. You've got great-great-grandchildren. If your family ever did get together for Christmas, it would be a bit of a mess. There'd be people in the corner doing pee, people in another corner smoking some joints. There'd be a whole lot of people getting drunk. There'd be fist fights. And you just feel ashamed. You're ashamed of everything you are. You're ashamed of everything that you have somehow become. But you don't know how to fix that because who you were was robbed by a complete injustice, and you just don't know how to reconcile it within your head. And it passes on, just to put this into history, it passes on for 150 years. Those sorts of things pass on. And then late in your life, you're 70, shall we say, someone comes along and says, "Hey, look, I was actually a part of that group that took your lands, and we've realized we were wrong. That was an injustice. I don't know that I can really make it up to you, but I've got an offer. And I want to say an apology. I'd like you to grab your family and bring them together. And we're going to apologize, and we're going to give you a token of apology. It's going to be $800,000. Are you going to accept it? You got $40 million of farms. You would probably own 20 farms by now, right? 50 years later, not just the 10 farms you had. You know, so you'd be worth far more than that. They're offering you $800,000, and then they've got these words, full and final settlement, on that piece of paper. You're going to take $800,000? Because at the end of the day, $800,000's better than nothing. So you take the $800,000. So do you want to understand why Māori don't feel overjoyed at the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi Tribunal settlements? You want to get a picture of the millions and millions of hectares that were taken? We spend around about $4 billion per year on the DPB looking after solo mothers. $4 billion. Do you know how much they set aside for all treaty settlements? $1 billion. $4 billion per year, $1 billion forever. It'll end up being maybe $1.5 billion at the end of it all. But, you know, this whole myth that we're bankrupting the nation, giving Māori all of this land and stuff, what a load of flippin' rubbish. We should double everything that we're given, and it still wouldn't bankrupt us. Let's start fixing families. We'll save more money than that every single year. So here you are, and so what you do is you move out of Tauranga, a little, you know, 30 minutes away, and for $800,000, you get yourself a small house, and you've got 10 acres of land, and you bring some of your family back on it, and You wake up in the morning, you have a smoke, and you got a coffee in your hands, you look at the dew settling on the grass, and you know what? For the first time in 50 years, you begin to feel like you're a man again. You're still grieving it, but you go out and there's a broken fence and you grab a grandkid or a great-grandkid, show them how to cut some dags off sheep's bums, you know. You do the things that a man does. You get out there in the nitty-gritty, your hands are dirty, and you feel like you're a little bit alive again. This is how Māori are beginning to feel right now. They're feeling like they're a little bit alive again. So the treaty is awesome. The Treaty of Waitangi is the most amazing document. It's standing on an explicitly Christian foundation with many Christian Māori involved, as well as almost an entirely Christian humanitarian effort out of England. As a Christian, it is your obligation to believe in the treaty and to honour it. There is a Waitangi dawn service here in Tauranga every single year. I know some guys locally have been praying that we'll have 500 Christians turning up to support each year. Waitangi Day, 6 a.m. Over by the mount at that hill that's about 500 metres from the mount, whatever that's called. Can I encourage you to do that? This is New Zealand Day, and this is the only reason you have rights to be here if you are a non-Māori like myself. Otherwise, you're a coloniser and it's time for you to leave. We need to develop bicultural grace. We need to develop bicultural interest and allow that to be fostered. We need to begin then to attempt bicultural things, attempt bits of te reo, put more stuff in church services, put more stuff in our work, our greetings on the phones, whatever it is. In the time of Joshua, the Gibeonites were living in the land. They knew they were going to be killed by Joshua and the Israelites. So they said, let's pretend that we come from a far off land. So with deception and old clothes, they come up and they said, Joshua, would you make a treaty with us? We come from far away, been traveling for months. And so he makes a treaty with them. Then discovers he's been deceived, says, ah, all right then. And so their lives and certain things get protected, but they get made servants within the community. Many, many, many years later, in the time of King David, the blessing of God has gone from the nation. The crops are failing and they say, God, why is this happening? And God says it's because of the Gibeonites. So they gather the Gibeonites, they make an apology and they restore them and begin to look after them again. A treaty made many years earlier by people you didn't know under a context of deception. The only difference between the Gibeonite story and the Treaty of Waitangi is in the Treaty of Waitangi, there was no deception. It was under God with integrity. We absolutely have to honour it. We have an obligation morally to honour. I'm like 3, 4, 5 minutes from landing. We have an obligation morally to honour it. But I think that from a gospel point of view, we need to make the story famous. That's what these exist for. There's only two widespread things in New Zealand getting this story in the public square: Hope Project and this series in schools. And we need far more activists. We've got a second wave of creatives now coming about who are beginning to share the story. I spoke about 150 times on this topic back in 2012, 13, 14 around the country. We've got denominational leaders now getting this in the last 5 years. Some have been doing great work. And I would say the tipping point in the New Zealand churches appreciation of our bicultural identity as a nation. To capture this, we're bicultural in identity, multicultural in practice. Because being multicultural is about giving common grace to all people, right? In the same way, we're Christian in identity, as measured by heritage and values, but multi-religious in practice. Because we give common grace to all people, because Christianity says the soul and the free will and the mind does exist, and religion can't be coerced. There has to be free choice. So a Christian society naturally allows for a multi-religious. We are Christian and bicultural in identity. We are multi-religious and multicultural because of common grace in practice. Just to understand and get those things in. But we also need to embrace, we need to make the story famous because it actually helps Māori reconnect with the gospel and Christianity, and that's significant because who's going to reach Māori? The answer is Māori are. So if we change and embrace bicultural values, Māori feel more comfortable in church, Māori embrace faith, and then they say, what the heck's happening on my marae? And then they go to the marae and they change it. So that's the process and that's how it happens. We don't have to become Māori. Right, but we do have to allow for bicultural grace. But the last thing I want to say, and I'm struggling for time here, sorry, but it's that our land is changing. And to give you the next 20-40 year forecast, the mana whenua, the mana connected to the land, the mana Māori, the mana connected to what it is to be Māori, these are being restored to Māori. You have iwi with their settlements who are saying our goal is to have none of our people on the unemployment benefit, and we're going to take care of our own education and healthcare. They are genuinely looking out for the well-being of their people with their investments and what they intend to do. There is good leadership sitting on marae around our country. We need to know that because the media won't tell us that. In the midst of this, the Māori economy is growing and, dare I say, even in danger of exploding. The Māori economy is $40 billion already. I predict some of our local iwi to be the largest contributors to the charity sector in about 20 years' time. Some could almost be so now, and within 40 years, many iwi could be amongst the biggest contributors to charity within our nation. One iwi who settled for $170 million early on is one of only two that got a 0% tax rate because the government needed to get some wins over the line. It's 18% for the rest, and those of you in business pay more than that. That iwi then blew $30 million on a casino and was accused of all kinds of scandals and spending of $1 million on a penthouse for the board to have holidays in and whatever else, right? That iwi is worth, technically, it's $1.37 billion today. That's $1,370 million. Within a year, that'll be $1.5 billion, so I'm just going to say $1.5 in my talks. Because if you know anything about business and 0% tax rates and what $1.5 billion does, we might as well just say $2 billion for argument's sake, or say $5 billion, or say $20 billion, because those figures are nothing more than about 10 to 12 years apart. Understand the growing economic power. Another thing that's changing is that the new Māori are more Māori than the previous Māori. As my neighbour in front of me says, that's not true, she says. We were told off if we ever spoke Māori, but I'm like, Auntie Gail, that's exactly the point, you know. And to give a story that Eleanor had recapped to me that I'd shared, you know, one of her things, she says, look, David, all I want, she says, is I want to be able to die on my own land. I just wish I could somehow have a home on my home marae and just I could live there. It's the yearning to be on the land. It's within the Māori DNA and the Māori culture. So the Kuta Kaupapa, which got going in around 75-ish, 1975-ish, kids growing up with te reo as their first language. Those kids are way over 30 years of age. Right, we got kids. I met a kid the other day. Oh, she's actually in her 20s, who had gone to high school and had to be pulled out because she still didn't know how to speak English, and went back to a Māori high school where she could be taught English. There is a type of Māori around who are university educated. They understand finance. They take pride in who they are. Things are changing. Biculturalism, however far you think it's gone, has got further to go. Bilingualism, however far you think it's gone, has a flippin' lot further to go. Three languages in New Zealand: te reo, Māori, English, sign. If I come to you and I speak Te Chu, if I speak Malay, the onus of interpretation is upon me to make myself clear, because those are not official languages in New Zealand, nor will they ever be. But if I come to you and I speak Te Reo Māori and you can't understand, that's your responsibility and your problem. Because we have three languages in New Zealand, Te Reo Māori, English, and sign. It is the grace of Māori to you that they speak to you in English. So understand that biculturalism and bilingualism have further to go. Understand also then the very significant gospel impact and cultural impact that Māori can have upon our society in the face of the secularisation of the West. The very intentional rebranding of New Zealanders as a secular nation within which children and public like ourselves are denied a knowledge of our Christian heritage and bicultural heritage, so that we are like a ship without a rudder and can be turned to go in a direction completely different to who we are. How do you stop secularisation? Well, I can't pray in a public meeting in the public square, but I can have karakia. Yeah. You're not allowed anything spiritual in the public square, but if I'm a Māori in a bicultural nation, the wairua, the spiritual, is an intrinsic part of everything that we do. We have a trump card in the battle against secularisation of our nation. We need to understand it, and I would say it's not only a trump card for Māori, though Māori need to lead the way in this, but it's actually a trump card for all New Zealanders, because I'm the Tangata Tiriti, and this is my treaty, and this is my land, and I'm in a bicultural land, and I accept a bicultural identity to an extent while I continue to journey into that biculturalism very slowly over time. So in conclusion, I hope this has been useful and interesting. If you would like the Treaty of Waitangi series, it's $50 here today. If you want the other series, they cost more because it's not the special then, but they're at bigbook.nz. That is the website. You could buy a big book for the same price as this, Keith Newman's Bible and Treaty, then followed by Beyond Betrayal, and they would give you big books if you're a reader like that. I'm not. You could read these. They are novels. They suit 80-year-olds and they suit 40-year-olds and 20-year-olds. And after you and your church leadership and everyone else has read them, then give them to your kids. And like my son Jonathan, during the morning sessions, he'll sit there reading them and getting that history as well. Please embrace things Māori. Please keep an open mind. Join the journey. It is happening. The church needs to be at the table. Māori power and influence is growing. If the church and Māori and green issues can all be combined, then the church in New Zealand will have a voice into the future. However, if it continues to be Labour, Māori and Greens and Christianity over there, we probably will not have a voice in the future. So, Father, I pray that you would help us as your people to honour the treaty in our nation that has been made in your name. Help us as a church to continue to journey, help us individually to journey, even if it's very small steps, that we would keep taking those steps forward. And I pray that by your grace, key people would be raised up within your church and each city and town who would become the bridge builders to local marae, and that there would be Māori leaders raised up who love you in every area as well, that the church would be at the table when the decision points come as to whether or not Christianity gets to remain in the public square of this nation. We ask for your favour and wisdom. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Cool.